Chapter 13. When the lighter slid into the bay in Khor's ship and was docked and locked, Dervla and Wynne were hustled along the walkway at gunpoint and through a sliding hatch. The passageways were narrow, the lighting was muted, and the few other crew members they passed on the way looked just as barbarous and feral as Khor and his guards, and seemingly of the same brawny humanoid species. And when they arrived at a brighter chamber and were pushed back into recesses that suddenly held them immobile, she knew, with a dark, bitter certainty, that she would never see Pike again. Wynne flung a string of florid curses in Anglic at their burly, over-armoured guards, eventually falling as silent as Dervla when her verbal stamina ran low. Moments later, the guards stiffened and hoisted their weapons as Khor entered, gave the human women a single appraising look and said,
"Are you able to understand me when I speak in the Omnilect?"
Dervla glowered at him. It was several hours ago that a couple of his skag-sniffing underlings force-fed them small crystalline capsules washed down with a spurt of brackish water.
"Sure, I can understand you," she said. "All we need to do now is learn how to swear in it."
"Not advisable, since new lives begin for you today. So, forget your pasts, and forget any notions of defiance. Those I obey have determined that you shall serve the needs of one of our supreme leaders. In time, you will understand what a great honor this is."
There was a sick feeling in Dervla's stomach.
"So, you're not with the rebels? But Pike and the others..."
"They have key parts to play in the grand drama about to unfold, and their inevitable deaths will ultimately serve the ends of my masters. But, as I have said, your fates lie along a different course."
Khor nodded to one of his guards, who stepped forward and sprayed something in Dervla's face before turning to do the same to Wynne.
"I will be greatly occupied for the next hour or two, so this sedative will help to allay any anxiety you may be feeling."
Dervla had caught the spray in her mouth and eyes, and the effects were coming on strong. A floating sensation and a numbness on the tongue, while her surroundings began to undulate and distort. As her mood lifted, Khor's face became a swollen, cartoonish monstrosity adorned with a single immense eye. Dervla was sure that she could see tiny, toothy-jawed fish swimming around inside it. She started to giggle and was on the verge of a mad outburst of laughing when a wave of narcotic nothingness swept over her. When she came to, it was in response to a harsh tickling in her throat, which led to a vicious and extended bout of coughing.
"My God, Derv, you okay?"
She cleared her throat, grimacing at the rawness.
"I think I live, though I may never sing opera classics again."
There was a knot of discomfort low down in her midriff, which quickly made its presence known.
"Wynne, how long were we out? I've got an urgent need to deal with."
"My optic timer says about 5 hours, said Wynne, "and you're not the only one. I woke about 10 minutes ago and got a guard to understand that if he didn't provide a bucket or something soon, he'd have some explaining to do when his boss came round."
She paused at the sound of rattling from the door. This might be him. One of the guards entered, flat-snouted auto-weapon over one shoulder, his other hand gripping a blue triangular tub. He put the container on the floor near Wynne's binding recess, then stepped back and pressed a button on a small wall panel. Released from the restraint field, Wynne staggered forward a pace, then bent, slightly, leaning on her knees.
"My companion needs to make water too," she said. "Please release her as well."
For a moment, the guard just glared. Then he grunted, thumbed the wall button again, and moved to the door. It slid aside. He stepped back, gun now aimed at them.
Then it slid shut. Dervla sagged, rubbing her aching wrists, then exchanged a look with Wynne. The two women began laughing. "I'd better go first," Wynne said. "I really wasn't kidding about an imminent disaster." The blue triangular tub had a circular twist-off lid, and while Wynne went first, Dervla took a closer look at the restraint field controls. But all she saw was a metal panel set flush with the polycomposite wall and two round buttons, likewise flush with the panel surface. Without some decent tools, the anti-tamper controls were effectively invulnerable. Then it was her turn. And where Wynne had uttered only a long sigh, Dervla let out a groan that turned into a low giggle.
"Derv, I swear you've got the dirtiest laugh sometimes."
She was fastening her camo leggings when the door slid open again. It was Khor, flanked by his guards. The battered, frontier merc leathers were gone, replaced by a close-fitting uniform in a fabric so profoundly black that no seams or details of any kind could be discerned. At the neck was an odd, high collar in a dark grey material, its sides extending to either shoulder where metallic badges sat. Matching gloves completed the ensemble. Recalling Khor's predictions as to the fate of Pike and the others, Dervla met the merc leader's gaze, quickly glanced at the guards as if gauging tactics, then tensed her shoulders and made a sharp forward motion. Khor immediately stepped back while barking an order and raising one arm. The guards brought their weapons to bear on Dervla, and Khor's outstretched grey-gloved hand blurred and was suddenly holding a long, thin blade. Dervla just laughed, relaxed her stance, and leaned back, folding her arms. She had not even taken so much as a step forward. Khor regarded her with restrained anger.
"You seek to test me. Yet I am no longer the one who controls your fate."
The slender dagger blurred in his hand, vanishing as he closed the gloved fingers in a fist.
"Now, hold out your wrists, both of you."
Opaque plastic bands were snapped into place, and Dervla could feel the fetters moulding themselves to the shape of her wrists as she and Wynne were marched out of the cell and along a narrow passage.
"Survive," she told herself. "Where there's life, there's vengeance."
After a couple of turns along short, dim corridors, they passed through a wide hatch and down a gantry leading outside the ship. They were, Dervla realised, in the docking bay of a much larger vessel, perhaps even an orbital of some kind. Despite the poor illumination, she straight away got a sense of the bay's size, which was respectably roomy. Ducts and piping latticed corroded bulkheads half lit by glow spikes scattered across a ceiling that bore the scars of old cables and conduits long since ripped down. And there was an armed welcoming party, a line of tall humanoids in shiny black goggle helmets and dark blue body armour, over which a purplish asymmetrical cloak was draped. All carried long weapons that looked as if they were moulded from night blue glass. The barrels ended in curved, beak-like muzzles. Dervla gazed enviously at the beautiful weapons, imagining pressing the cold smoothness of one against her chin as she sighted along the barrel. Two tall figures stepped into view, taller than either Khor's mercs or the armed guards. They wore grey and white robes split from the waist, with armless jerkins over their torso, their ochre-quilted chests dotted with a variety of metallic sigils and emblems. Their scalps were enclosed by close-fitting caps, the front of which extended down like a mask over the eyes, which were hidden behind dark, impenetrable lenses. As they approached, Khor crossed his arms across his upper chest and gave a stiff bow.
"Luxeta Khor, be welcome aboard the Deliverance of Judgment," said the shorter of the pair. "I am Lord Meteor Gezath. This is Lord Meteor Emendar. The Master is discussing the Armag operation with the new Zavri First Blade, but has asked that you be brought straight to the command chamber without delay. He is keen to assess your offerings.
Dervla glanced at Wynne, who met her gaze with a dark and worried expression.
Flanked by the dark-armoured troops, Khor's party set off, led by the Lord's Meadiary, who headed for a tall exit in the corner of the bay. Khor walked between them, but even though they were only a few metres ahead, Dervla could barely make out the occasional word above the noise of tramping feet.
Offerings, she thought bleakly. Sounds like another word for bribe.
The route led along corridors, up oddly springy stairs and through lobbies, all fairly spacious. While the Deliverance of Judgment was undoubtedly a capital ship, its interior design was turning out to be yet another variant of iron-fisted Gothic. The architecture was half temple, half monumental, and all about the worship of power. A single symbol was repeated over and over in wall mouldings, on decorative hangings, and on floor patterns. A hand holding a dagger with an eye in its blade. The warlike symbolism was obvious, but the eye staring out from the blade was unusual, even unsettling, when used as an omnipresent decorative element. At last, they came to a double-door entrance, which parted in sections from top to bottom. It made a quiet, rhythmic hiss, like a series of blades being drawn forth. Inside, the ceiling sloped up towards the far wall of a buttress-walled chamber of a fair size, although slightly less imperious than Dervla had been expecting. Narrow spot beams speared down upon tall, silvery figures standing in motionless, glittering ranks facing forward. As the Lord's Meadiary led them into the chamber, Dervla noticed that their armed escort were remaining outside and taking up sentry positions along the corridor. Dervla and Wynne were made to stand in the shadows at the rear, flanked by Khor's guards, while the gathering of shining forms continued. In the tense hush, a deep, rasping voice was speaking.
"Misealed, trapping the Outworlders within Giamatu's tower. The Tower Guard is under orders to convey the Lord Governor to the inner refuge and pull all their squads back to protect it. You, First Blade, and your Zavri will enter at the base of the tower and scour it from bottom to top, leaving no avenues of escape. Keep in mind that I wish the Outworlders taken alive, so that they may be displayed and seen all across the war cage. Zavri combat skills should be equal to such a task."
"It shall be as you command, High One," said a second voice.
"These interlopers will be no match for battle-hardened Zavri veterans." "An excellent declaration, Akreen. It pleases me that you have adapted to your new rank with such zeal. Leave now. When we next meet, it will be to celebrate the new heights of glory attained by the Zavri."
"Typical," Dervla thought. "As usual, I can't see what's happening on stage because of all the tall people blocking the way."
They were flippant thoughts, but the best she could do in an attempt to keep her worst fears at bay.
"Eternal loyalty to the Shuska," said the voice of Akreen.
"Loyalty eternal,"
the ranks of silver Zavri warriors replied in unison. As Dervla watched, the ranks drew aside to form an aisle down the centre. There were heavy footsteps, and another tall silver figure, presumably the recently promoted Akreen, strode into view. These Zavri were tall and broad-shouldered, with shiny, smooth forms that were seemingly sexless. Akreen, on the other hand, was decked out in ceremonial garb, bulky archaic armour, abundantly provided with symbols and emblems, a glittering regalia. Looking neither left nor right, the Zavri leader marched from the chamber, followed by a double column of his troops. As they filed out, the other side of the chamber was revealed, a low, curved dais with a large chair, in which there sat a Shuskar. Unlike the two Lords Mejiri, this one wore no headgear, and the dominant colour of its attire was a deep red, a long, plain, coat-like affair with another of those high collars. It also seemed to be holding the stock grip of a long-barrelled weapon, the bulk of which was resting on a spidery stand, angled to point at the ceiling. The array of spot beams speared the deck before the dais like a square cage of glowing columns, yet the enthroned Shuskar leader was not well illuminated. Neither were the half-dozen shorter figures who were stationed around the edge of the dais. One of them beckoned to the Lord's Mejiri, who looked round at Khor and muttered,
"Follow!"
The procession crossed the floor. Nearing the dais, they passed through the bright beams, and Dervla was dazzled twice, three times, and, after her vision adjusted, the dais and all it held took on more detail and clarity. As Pike second in command, she had travelled to a good number of exotic, out-of-the-way locales and clapped eyes on some conceptually and viscerally challenging sights. But few had struck as deep into the core of her fears as the creature that watched her approach.
"Ah, my offerings, a new species, new DNA to taste."
This close, Dervla noticed the other humanoid figures spaced around the dais. Gaunt, listless, and androgynous in appearance, they were swathed in grubby windings of thin, pale blue material, against which the waxy pallor of their skin scarcely contrasted. Bony hands held chunky-looking auto-pistols of an unusual design. Red-rimmed eyes stared out from folds of the same stained sheeting. When they regarded Khor, his guards and captives, it was with a pitiless disdain. When they gazed at the seated Shuskar leader, it was with adoration.
"Most paramount, Exrahald," began Lord Mejiri Gezath. "Your servant, Luxator Khor, seized these two humans in order to coerce the remainder of the Outworlder party into carrying out their parts in your insurpassable drama. Shortly thereafter, he realized that these captives should be gifted to you as a tribute to your supreme greatness."
"Boot-licking barfmonger," Dervla thought. From his throne, the Shuskar, known as Exrahald, surveyed them all thoughtfully. There was a curious atmosphere in the room, a subdued watchfulness, an ambience of something cold at rest, yet with an edge of anticipation. Then, her attention settled on the long-barrelled weapon, dull brown with a thick muzzle, still resting on its stand. Only now she could see that it was actually an extension of the Shuskar's arm. Then she saw where a protrusion emerged from the side of the weapon, lengthening into a flattened tentacle which coiled around the arm and up the shoulder, looping around the back of the neck to curl under the jaw and further up to merge into the skin at the temple. Tentacle and weapon were one, a biomechanical whole, adorned with bony ridges, membranes stretched over glowing nodules, even scars and traceries of veins. Dervla felt oddly light-headed as her deep, reflexive dread transmuted into a surging, clawing terror, a terror which she was resolved not to show. Wynne wasn't faring as well. When Exrahald leisurely got to his feet, she closed her eyes and started praying. The Shuskar lifted its gun arm, cradled it in the other with an odd gentleness, then descended from the dais. The scrawny, sheet-garbed acolytes tracked him with their revering eyes. The Lord's Mejiri looked on from behind their strange dark lenses, and Khor just grinned. Exrahald loomed over Wynne, studying her with a piercing gaze, nostrils flaring as he inhaled deeply. Dervla's attention, though, was drawn to the grotesque semi-organic weapon. It was clearly a biomech implant designed in accordance with some anomalous combat paradigm. Indicators glowed and pulsed beneath its blemished epidermis, so energy had to be coming from somewhere. Body heat, perhaps? Also, going by the round muzzle, she was pretty sure that the weapon fired a heavy slug or projectile which would allow for a wide range of possible ammunition. And just then, as she was studying the biomech weapon, a lump halfway along the barrel opened and an eye stared out at her. Her intake of breath was involuntary. Exrahald's gaze swung round, and with a single stride he was standing before her, his very presence bearing down like a weight. "Can't cave in," she thought. "Maybe we are dead, but damn them all if I go out like a whipped dog." By sheer force of will, she made herself look up into that alien gaze and crack a devil-dodging grin. "Morning, Your Majesty. Nice ship you got here." There was a palpable increase in tension and a long moment of stillness. Exrahald bent his head while staring down at her, as if he was scrutinising a nasty stain on the floor and wanted a closer look. Then that thin-lipped mouth widened into a horrible smile full of splintered teeth.
"Hey, species with spirit," the Shuskar leader said to the Lord's Mejuri and Kor. "And, doubtless, a world worth the harvesting. I find your offerings most acceptable, Luxeta Khor. They suit my requirements."
Exrahald glanced over his shoulder at one of his wan acolytes.
"Prepare them!"
Khor's guards stepped back as four of the sheet-garbed acolytes seized Dervla and Wynne and pushed them away from the dais and all those gathered there. Like Wynne, Dervla had one heavy pistol aimed at her from the side and another pressed in the nape of her neck, as they were both steered towards a concealed entrance in a side wall. A sliding door led into a small chamber smelling of something vaguely ammonia-like. There were four tall, transparent cylinders, one in each corner, all empty and sitting open. From their bases, cables snaked over to wall sockets, while carts, like large grey bowls on wheels, were parked next to them. The sight did not inspire confidence. One of the acolytes waved her pistol in Dervla's face and plucked at her clothing.
"Outsides! Take off!"
Wynne was getting the same treatment, and a minute or so later, barefoot and down to their underkit, each was being shoved into a big cylinder. A curved section slid shut with a faint hiss, and its edges seemed to dissolve, leaving the cylinder a seamless hole. The pistol-packing acolytes then picked up the discarded garments and, without a backward glance, left the way they came in. Dervla watched them go, then leaned against the inside of her cylinder and gave it a shove, then again, then slammed both hands against the cold surface, finally kicking as hard as bare flesh could stand. Nothing. Not a crack, not a rattle, not the slightest movement. Not only was it made from touch, impact-resistant materials, it was also solidly anchored to the deck. Across the room, Wynne was holding her shoulder as she gave her prison an irritable, if feeble, kick. Then she waved at Dervla and said something. Hearing nothing, Dervla pointed at her ears and shook her head.
"Can't hear a thing,"
she shouted, even though it was pointless. For a few moments they stood there, looking silently and dolefully out at each other. Then Wynne held out her hands towards Dervla with a "now what" look on her face. But all Dervla could do was shrug. Wynne glowered and leaned back against the inside of her cylinder, arms crossed. They were isolated and vulnerable, the prerequisite to either interrogation or brainwashing, and since neither of them knew anything about the chain of resistance, they might be in for a bit of both. But what did the Shuskar leader mean when he said, "a new species, a new DNA to taste"? Such speculative brooding ended a few minutes later when the red-coated Shuskar leader entered the white room and strode over to Dervla's cylinder. Three of the sheet-wound acolytes trailed in after him, mesmeric devotion in their faces. There they are, she thought. The brides of Frankenstein. Exrahald smiled at them as they gathered around him, glancing at Dervla as if gauging her reaction. That grotesque gun arm was now supported in a webby sling, carefully positioned to allow the creepy eye a view of its surroundings. She tried to ignore it as the Shuskar turned his attention towards her, passing a gnarly hand across a point on the outside of the glassy surface. A glowing tracery of symbol strings and odd flickering emblems appeared for a moment, then melted away.
I assume that you can hear me, came the Shuskar's rich yet gravelly voice.
The base of the cylinder was a couple of inches higher than the deck, so, although the Shuskar was still the taller, Dervla felt slightly less shrunken and dominated, but only slightly. She nodded. Guess that means you can hear me too, she said.
Understanding each other is important, of course.
Exrahald raised his gun arm and tapped its muzzle on the outside of the cylinder quite soundlessly. The gun's eye gazed unwinkingly at Dervla.
Your companion seemed to find my appearance frightening. What do you behold?
Dervla leaned forward to stare at the eye. Its pupil was large and dark, unfathomable. Do you see what your gun sees? She said.
What the Tokor sees, I see also. Do you experience no fear? The monitor web tells a very different story.
Of course I've got the fear,
she burst out, slamming her open hand against the cold inner surface.
I'm scared of being turned into whatever you are, of being joined to a festering chunk of biomech, feeling my mind being infected by it.
The Shuskar Exrahald's laugh was deep, throaty, and unpleasant.
None can become as we are. Only five of the Tokor were ever found, and the Gunlords number five, as they have for many centuries. You and your companion are fated to become more than you are, to take up service to the Gunlords, to guard the manifest supremacy with your new lives.
A dread suspicion crept over Dervla as she glanced at the sheet-clad acolytes.
Never!
She cried.
I'll never serve you!
Laughing, Exrahald went over to Wynne's cylinder. She was sitting on the small circular floor, clasping her knees, and drew away as the Shuskar tapped some symbols on the glassy exterior. As Dervla watched, the Shuskar then brought its gun arm round and pressed its muzzle against the cylinder. Wynne was on her feet and coughing as grey vapour swirled around her. Exrahald glanced round at Dervla, grinning as he retracted the gun muzzle and sauntered back across the room. He stood before her, angling the gun arm so that the eye could see her. Then glowing symbols were tapped, and Dervla saw how a circular aperture opened in the glassy curve. As the gun muzzle came up, she lunged forward to press her hands against the hole, but it was no good. Grey vapour still managed to seep in, oozing between her fingers, spreading fine smoky threads through the air around her. She could smell it, taste it, a cold, vaguely coppery taint, which, once savoured, did not fade.
You will be changed,
came the Shuskar's voice as she hunched down, trying not to sob, as hot tears slid down her cheeks.
We subjugate you, we remake you, then we command you. We have always done this, and always will.
She could not answer. Terror choked her throat, and strange minuscule things like translucent glyphs were swimming across her vision, across her eyes.